Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to yet another exciting show. Now, we don't really give our friendships the credit we should these days for how much they mean to our lives. Yeah, we value our friends. But as I wrote in I See Root People, starting around 1949, and then increasingly as all these decades went on, we started becoming very transient. So people used to live in the same house or neighborhood with their extended family, and now many people now have their immediate family dispersed all over the country. And you find more and more, whether people admit it or not, that friends are more family than they've ever been. And so I was very excited to see one of the best editors I've ever worked with, Carlin Flora, who edited my Psychology Today piece about beauty, had written a book on just this topic. Her book is called Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. And it talks about the ins and outs of friendship, the dark sides, and the great influence friends have on us. And that's what we'll be talking about tonight, including how to make and drop friends, and how friends can make each other better and have more satisfying friendships. So hello, Carlin.
Hi.
Hi. So you're one of the few non-scientists to appear on my show, but your book's really research-driven, and I've always found you solid on science. So I think that you are just like a PhD, except without the PhD.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving me the honorary title.
So you write about how Ethan Waters, who wrote Urban Tribes, feels as I do, that friends are often the new family. And this is in part because of delayed marriage and the early emphasis on career. Do you feel that way also?
I do. And when Ethan Waters explored this trend, he was focusing on people in their 20s and 30s. And what's happened since then is we've discovered that that age bracket is really widening up. So, for example, 40% of households in big cities are composed of just one person. So it's not just delayed marriage, which, you know, that's the marriage age rates continue to rise, but it's also just more people at older ages deciding not to marry or being divorced or living with friends instead of relatives, living with roommates. So it's really across the board, all the demographic trends kind of point to friends fulfilling roles that families used to fill.
And so your book is called Friendfluence. So tell us what Friendfluence is.
Right. So Friendfluence is my cute term for what is really the powerful and often unappreciated role that friends play in determining who we are, our sense of self, the direction of our lives. So as you mentioned, you know, we do value our friends, we cherish them, but we don't tend to think of them as driving our biography. You know, for example, when you read the biography of a famous person, it usually focuses on his or her parents. So this is sort of giving friendship its due in terms of how these vital relationships help us develop over time throughout our lives.
You actually wrote pretty fascinatingly about a group of artists in Paris, the Impressionists, who had this friend group where they really influenced each other's art. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's an example of how friendship can really spur creativity. So this is not your typical, brainstorming in an office. These are people who have authentic friendships. And because they have this authentic friendship and talk about how to advance, say, in this case, art, they are able to sort of let their guard down and express their wildest ideas, and then through the friendship build on each other's ideas. And the example I have is of Impressionism, that, you know, there were this sort of a gang of painters who together kind of came to discover Impressionism, and that their friendship, you could sort of think of it as mechanism. And I love this because it kind of takes us out of the myth of the lone creative genius. And if you think about it in your own life, if you're doing something creative, you want to impress your friends, you want to show it to your friends and share it with your friends. So it's really more of a social process than we might think.
Yeah, and I love the term. You quoted theology professor Michael Farrell talking about collaborative circles among these. It was Sisley and Renoir and Monet and Bazille. And mm-hmm. I certainly have that in my life. I don't know if that's the same for you, but that there are a number of writers that I turn to when I'm freaked out about something, or mm-hmm. just I was stuck in a place in my book, and I had this hour and a half Skype conversation with a friend who was stuck in her work, and she's totally different area. She's a professor. But we both helped each other. It was such a feel-good thing to have somebody spurring you on.
Exactly. And he even has a term for that of instrumental intimacy. And it's just what I was saying about being able to share your kind of craziest ideas, and then more importantly, being able to bounce them off another person who really understands the inner workings of your mind. And you know what I mean? If you're trying to share something that's kind of new and progressive, it helps to share it with someone who kind of knows where you're going with your thoughts because they know you so well. So yeah, I think that is so typical for a lot of people in the arts, and that applies to sciences as well. You know, there are some teams who are truly friends who tend to be very productive because they sort of understand each other's strengths and weaknesses in a way that can really propel their research forward.
And we will get to the dark side, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the differences between men and women. And I like your book because it's really well written scientifically. You put in the caveat. So Jeffrey Grieve, mm-hmm. who's a professor of social work, he says, look, although some gender differences in friendship can be tracked, they don't apply to all men and women. But he did say that men tend to have shoulder-to-shoulder friendships and women face-to-face friendships. What does that mean?
Right. So that means you can think of two guys sitting, you know, sitting side by side fishing, not really talking, and that's sort of, you know, capturing their friendship. And you can think of two women in a cafe facing each other, talking, and the conversation is what drives the friendship. So, you know, he did find these distinctions in the surveys that he conducted, but as you mentioned, he threw in the caveat. And I think there's... if you kind of want to take a broader view, you know, there's an anthropologist named Daniel Hruska who looked at friendship across cultures, and he really found more gender similarities than differences. So I think that's good to keep in mind because you don't want to sort of be limited by that stereotype. I know plenty of guys who spill their guts to their guy friends, and I'm sure you do too.
Oh, yeah, you wrote about that, and I thought that was something important. I do too. And also, I tend to be more direct. I mean, not with everyone. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. and this is something you talked about where women tend to express bad things covertly where men are overt. I wrote a column of this that, you know, women will, you know, go behind your back and be all mean girls, and the guys will stalk right. each other, then go off and have a beer.
Right. Well, there's an Anne Mara Lindberg quote that is fantastic that says, you know, men kick friendship around like a football and it never cracks, whereas women treat it like glass and it breaks. I'm misquoting it. But anyway, the idea being that women are so afraid of conflict that they ironically end up ramping up the conflict because they don't vent these little frustrations with their friends in the moment. And it builds up into something that could be a big argument or, you know, a friendship falling apart.
Yeah, interesting. You say there doesn't seem to be much of a dark side to male friendship, maybe because the guys just have it out instead of, you know, doing this sort of like we're going to keep it all behind the scenes and leave it ugly.
Yeah, I think a dark side to male friendship would be that, you know, again, according to Jeffrey Grieve's work, that they're not as likely to make the effort to keep up the friendship. So they might be a little bit more passive, and then they'll suffer because having a solid group of friends is so important to your health and your happiness and these sort of other areas of your life. So it might be sort of a more subtle, long-term dark side, but the result of maybe not keeping up with friends as carefully as women might.
So I want to talk about the Harry and Sally thing, speaking of men and women as friends. So can men and women be friends?
So this is my pet topic. So glad you asked, because every year it seems a headline comes out that says men and women can't be friends, and it always gets a million hits. And it's just not true. They can be friends. We know they can be friends. So then the question is, why do we love this myth? Why do we click on these articles that say they can't be friends? And, you know, I think just the simple answer is that it's a little more complicated. You might have sexual tension that takes a long time to work out. You have to have that sort of moment where you kind of get over the question, are we going to be romantic or not? But once you get over that moment, I think there's just so many benefits to it. And that is definitely a generational shift, in that younger people are much more apt to report having a friend of the opposite sex than older people. So I think we're gonna see that kind of Harry met Sally conundrum will be sort of phased out.
Oh, good, because it's a bore. What are some of the benefits of cross-sex friendships?
You know, I think it's just the simple thing of seeing something from the other gender's perspective. I think a friend of the other sex is the perfect person to discuss your romantic relationships with, because they won't get into that sort of almost over-empathizing with your point of view. They will be able to sort of pull back and help you see where your, you know, feelings aren't really helping your logic. So I think that's a basic reason. And then it's just sort of a matter of pulling out a different side. You know, if we're going to go with that shoulder-to-shoulder and face-to-face paradigm, you know, maybe you can, if women who have guy friends might get out and do more activities, and men who have female friends might get a chance to talk more. So it's just kind of letting different sides of yourself out and helping you relate in your romantic relationships much better.
Yeah, and you talk about in various places why that's important. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Carolyn Flora, and her book is Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. Okay, casual sex with friends. I have to talk about that. Justin Laymiller, in 2010, he's a researcher, looked at gender differences in people having casual sex with at least one friend. And the surprising thing was that both men and women seem to be more committed to the friendship than the sexual aspect of the friendship.
Right. So friendship might just be better than sex. In these instances, the couple is primarily concerned with preserving the friendship. That's sort of what scares them the most. Even if one person would sort of rather it go in a romantic direction and the other person would rather it not go into a romantic direction, they both agree that they would like to hold fast to their friendship. Now, of course, as I'm sure you know from the sort of evolutionary psychology perspective of love and sex, if you have sex with your friend, you are more likely to fall in love with him or her because of the different release of hormones that will happen during sex. So it's sort of you're putting yourself at risk for falling in love.
And so Greg just sent me a Chris Rock quote. He said, men don't have platonic friends. We just have women we haven't had sex with yet.
Yeah, and there have been some studies that have confirmed that idea that men are more likely to be attracted to female friends than vice versa. So, yeah, the thought that the guy is sort of a little bit holding out, hoping that the woman will eventually come around and sleep with him. But like I said before, I think if you kind of get over that question, then you can have a pretty even-handed friendship.
And now, very interestingly, you talk about your own best friend and how you were drawn to her in a way that resembled falling for someone romantically. I have to say, I know you're heterosexual and you have a husband and a baby and everything. But this is a feeling not unlike in the way others describe their friendships. It's almost a romantic thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I just remember being in, the college dorm cafeteria and seeing her and just being so drawn to her and having almost like a premonition that we're going to be friends. And then she sort of knocked on my door looking for my roommate who shared a class with her, and it just sort of felt a little bit faded. And I think it's so interesting because it sort of gets at this, kindred spirit notion. And maybe sometimes it's just a story that we pin on something after the fact. And I think the same with romance, that you can have that love at first sight, or you can have a very mundane beginning that, you know, later grows into a romance. So I think it can happen both ways with friendship and both ways with romance. But that sort of friendship at first sight thing, I think, gets at intuition and the fact that we just sense that someone will get us. And I think having someone who gets you is really the key beauty of friendship.
Now, let's talk about some of the ways people make friends. You say that major life events and changes make people long for social support. Do people just sort of think, I'm feeling, you know, sort of lost, okay, I'm going to look around the cafeteria?
Well, that's the thing. We're not usually conscious about making friends. I think a lot of people resolve, okay, I'm going to start dating because I really want to find a romantic partner. But we rarely resolve to make friends. We're much more passive about friendships. So, you know, that's sort of one theme of my book, is that I want people to be more conscious about how we form friends, since they do influence us a lot. But that said, I think if you're going through a specific transition, like becoming a new mom, you do sometimes seek out people almost like as a support group who are going through the exact same thing. And that can be a really great sort of kickstarter to a new friendship, because you can really share all those similar feelings, and that kind of ramps up the bonds and helps you to become closer more quickly than you would if you were just to meet under another circumstance.
And now here's an interesting thing you wrote about. You talk about how once we disclose a feeling or experience to somebody, we're more attracted to him or her. So maybe if you want to make friends, if you're one of those people who ask people about themselves rather than just talking about yourself, that you'll become more popular more quickly.
Yeah, that's a great practical application. Yeah, it's just sort of this kind of cognitive trick that we play on ourselves, where if I reveal something, I like you more because I sort of need you, you know, to like me. I'm becoming vulnerable, and so it is. Yeah, it is interesting, because we usually think about social skills and influence as being all about asking questions. But I think that would be a really good experiment, is to at your next cocktail party reveal something to someone and see if you then tend to sort of like them more.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I wanted to mention, you wrote about this very proactive woman. I love this. She had moved to Chicago for her husband's job, and she went on 52 friend dates to combat the loneliness, to look for friends. I think that is so cool.
Yeah, Rachel Birch, she wrote a book called Married White Female Seeking BFS. It's really funny. And yeah, she really exemplifies to the hilt what I'm saying about being conscious about making new friends. And, you know, one thing that sticks in my mind about her experience is that she found that, you know, the standard advice is to sign up for a class, right, in order to make new friends. So she signed up for an acting improv class, and she found that not only did she meet friends in the class, but that the idea, the lessons of acting and improvisation really helped her make friends overall, because she realized that conversation is all about improvisation. So I thought that was an interesting insight from her experience of 52 friend dates.
I think that's very helpful to become more comfortable socially. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Carlyn Flora, and her book we're discussing is Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. And now, you say one way to deepen friendship is to expand the ways you interact with someone, to cultivate what researchers call multiplexity, which is a word that means diversifying your activities in order to, to meet somebody in some new place, bring them to meet your family. I'm not sort of making sense, but explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think this has a really fun practical application too. It's basically, if you think of things on dimensions, a lot of our friends, we only know them on one dimension. We only meet them for dinner, right? Or we only see them at swim class. So if you want to ramp up a friendship, you just want to diversify and be able to see them in different contexts and sort of integrate them into the different areas of your life. So instead of just meeting for that, you know, Wednesday dinner, you want to go to invite them home, you know, to your house for Thanksgiving, and then they'll just see you in the context of your family, and it will be like, you know, reading a new novel all about you, because they'll see you in terms of all these family dynamics. so I think that's just a nice little tip, because we can fall into friend ruts where we kind of, you know, we have our yoga friend or our school friend. And if you just sort of take people out of those contexts, you can really become a lot closer to them.
Yeah, and sort of see, wow, you're like this, or you're like me. I had a friend come over here. She was in from Michigan, and I spent like 3 days cleaning my house. And when I was in Michigan, she didn't want to let me look in her office, and I wanted to see it because I think she's cool and interesting. And she said, oh, no. And I said, you have no idea. That's not what my house normally looks like. To see that stuff and then to reveal those things to your friends that actually, you know, you weren't such a – you know, civilized human being, that's sort of a mark of friendship too, you know, where you can just be somebody who is exposed and they see all your bad sides.
Right. Oh, exactly. And, you know, it's like the friend who you can just go to their house and open their refrigerator without asking. That's, you know, kind of a little sign that you're intimate. And yeah, that's the ideal. That's what we all want, is to be able to really just be our true selves and to be completely comfortable with someone.
Or another sign of friendship, and we'll get into this tit-for-tat thing. A friend of mine comes over, my friend Kate, and she cleans my house. She'll start Windexing things while she's here. And I'm not disgusting, but I'm writing
a book.
I want
to be her friend.
I know. She said, I should come over and clean your house. And I did want to say, yeah, that'd be great. It seemed kind of rude. But so, okay, you write about, you know, let's talk about how tit-for-tat is friendship, how much of an exchange there needs to be. You write about Cosmetis and Tubi, these evolutionary psychologists I know, and they noticed that people got upset when they heard that friendship was based on this sort of trade, you know, and in fact, the insistence of an immediate repayment is generally taken as a sign of a lack of friendship, a payment, repayment for some favor or something somebody's done, that real friends, you say, care less about inequality.
Right. So for years, researchers sort of described friendship as a tit-for-tat, as a reciprocal arrangement that would ramp up over time. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. And then Tubi and Cosmetis came along and realized that this did not resonate with people's conscious experience of friendship. And so they kind of explored different theories that would allow for you know, the exact opposite effect, which is that if I lend my friend $20, you know, I don't really care, and I don't even think about it. Whereas if I lend a coworker $20, I am going to expect them to pay me back. And what they found is it's really more of, you have to sort of think of how our brain would be drawn to certain friends based on who would help us in the evolutionary environment. So if we were living in a sort of tribal environment where we needed to rely on different people for survival, we would sort of want almost like a portfolio of friends. One person would be good at this skill, say hunting, another person would be good at wayfaring, you know, and so on and so forth. So almost like a balanced approach where it's not simply a tit for tat. It's sort of creating an environment where we have friends who will look out for our various interests. So it's interesting to think that unconsciously we're kind of gathering groups a group of friends that could have helped us in that kind of environment.
And actually, interestingly, one thing that I've learned, I grew up, I didn't have friends. I talked about this before on the show until I was like 13. I grew up around horrible children. It's horrible, horrible. We'll talk a little bit about childhood. But I had to learn how to ask favors of people. And actually being able to ask a favor of a friend is a sign of friendship, you know, that they're your friend and that you are able to impose upon them, rather than saying, oh, I shouldn't, the way you would think about some person that you don't know that well. Well, then it's if you're a polite person.
Right. It's a privilege to do a favor for a friend. So, yeah, there's studies where people have commented that they would, or concluded that they would be hurt if a friend didn't ask them to do a certain favor and paid for the service instead, or asked a stranger. So that's a nice another little nice reversal of common sense, is that if you want to become closer to a friend, ask her for a favor. And she won't be annoyed. She will be pleased that you trust her with that, and it will make her feel good and virtuous to carry it out.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, and that people need to do as I did, where you do this and you think, like, oh, they're going to think I'm awful and rude and everything, and test the waters, ask somebody for a little favor, then ask for more and more, and you really see that people, you know, who care about you, I mean, you can't just ask anybody, well, you could, maybe they'd say yes, but that this bond grows. And then, you know, and you want to do stuff for them too. I've always wanted to do stuff for people I cared about, but, you know, to fill in the other side of that is important and balanced and a sign that you're no longer seriously insecure.
Right. And, you know, if no one's asking you for favors, you have to look around and say, or, you know, look within and think, well, why is this? Why does no one feel that, you know, that I can provide help in that way? So maybe that's a sign that, yeah, your friendships aren't as close as you think.
Yeah. And now another thing that you say, you quote Dr. Carolyn Weiss, who's a psychologist and researcher. She's found evidence that the best friendship offers social identity support, you know, basically an affirmation of yourself and your place in a group. And you say that this at first seems like another way of saying that people like people who are similar to them, but that identity goes way beyond that, and support means more than sort of touchy-feely cheerleading.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So identity is, and this is really particularly important, I think, for young adults who are kind of finding their way in the world. Identity is not just who you are on the surface, but it's where you see yourself going. You know, if I'm studying acting in school, and that is my goal, you want friends who see you as an actress and treat you that way and treat that future identity seriously. And I think this is really important, because if you have friends who reflect the identity that you are growing into, it will just sort of effortlessly lift you up into that, and it will help you with your goals. Because if friends don't see you that way, they sort of subtly undermine you and don't give you that sort of confidence that you need, the sort of fake it till you make it confidence that a friend who really believes in you can give. And the support is really, you know, it can be practical support, but it's not, you know, cheerleading, you can do this. It's more that deeper kind of recognition that you can become this kind of person that you're striving to become.
Yeah, and you write about friends as mutual role models, and I love that term, and I see that with writer friends of mine. Mm. I will sometimes go on Facebook and post something about some hellish writing day, or, you know, a friend of mine talked to me at a party about, you know, his sort of writing trauma, and then people's successes, you see, wow, you know, they're in my peer group, that's possible, and it sort of opens things up for you.
It does, and it makes it real, because you can, you know, read a story about, you know, an unknown, or a writer that's not known to you who's been through certain things, but when you see a friend go through it, then you can really relate and you can really identify with that process, and the lesson is just, it's just much more tangible and powerful. And I think that there's sort of a negative connotation to making friends in the field in which you want to be successful. It's sort of lumped in with, you know, ladder climbing or social climbing, these sort of ugly kinds of notions. But I really think it's the best career advice is to befriend people. You know, you have to have an authentic friendship, obviously. It can't just be anybody in the field. But if you connect with someone in the field that you know, in which you want to grow, then that's really the best way to, you know, not just get the practical advice, but to get that identity support. So you'll just find over time that the people who surround themselves with others with the same career goals, those are the ones who rise up over time. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. And actually, according, you know, along the lines of what you were saying, that the person who is becoming your sort of mentorish friend, that they get something out of this too. You know, you're teaching and you're reinforcing what you need to also be reminded of. And it feels good to help people. You know, there's all this research on that by Sonia Lubomirsky and other people about how it's good to be good. You feel good. People like you better. And so this has, you know, multiple benefits.
Absolutely. And again, it's a little bit of a dirty secret or something we don't like to say out loud, but friends give friends jobs. And, you know, as we move more and more toward a freelance economy, I think that friends will be kind of a key to securing gigs in a lot of different fields. So it's just another reason to really cultivate friendships with
fact,
people who understand where you're going.
Mm-hmm. And when I wrote to you saying, oh, will you be on my show? I said, oh, you should send your stuff to my friend so-and-so who will sell your work. know, he's a great friend. You're a friend. I can recommend you. I know you both. So I can say, oh, you'll really like her. You'll really like him. Good guy. Really nice. You know, really talented. All that stuff where, you know, just to recommend somebody in a straight business sense, I think people trust that less now because there's so much LinkedIn and link this and link that and so much of that ladder climbing that the friend, you know, friend networking, I don't have a cute name for it at this second, but that's becoming increasingly important.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's just, it's more, it's sincere. It comes out of what you're saying of that sort of, you know, personal desire and the value of helping others and giving of yourself. So it's not this kind of cold, I need to network with these 10 people. It's, you know, who are my you know, genuine friends and how can I help them? And then it's sort of a virtuous circle because the more you all sort of become more successful together, the more you can help each other. And that's, you know, that's if you want to go a little further in that analysis, that's why I think it's really hard for, you know, for example, kids from communities where there's not a lot of professionals to really get visions of themselves in a professional career because their friends don't have parents with those jobs. So it's kind of an argument for more, almost kind of more cross-class friendships, if you will, to sort of help people kind of form different goals and reach, you know, higher goals.
Oh, I want to get to that. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Carolyn Flora, and her book is Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. And as you quote a researcher I really like, Judith Rich Harris, who says that one way parents exert a big influence over their kids, and we should say first, I've had Peter Gray on. We've talked about how kids' peer influence is really, really important in kids, much more so than parents like to admit. But she says, Judith Rich Harris says that parents exert a big influence by choosing where they live and go to school, which influences, as you were saying, which group they hang out with, which influences whether they'll commit crimes, drop out, use drugs, or get pregnant.
Right. So Judith Rich Harris believes that parents, beyond the genetic contribution, parents have no influence. So her position is pretty extreme. But she said, as you quoted, that they do have influence because in the sense of, you know, deciding where the child lives. And the research to back that point up would be some really fascinating stuff about, for example, a kid who's from a house where there's a single mother and the income is low, but who happens to live in a middle-class neighborhood does just as well as his peers. So, and another little tidbit is that children of divorce end up doing worse, not because of the divorce per se, but because divorce usually leads to the mother moving them to a poorer area. And so that is what really affects their outcomes and not the absence of a father, say. So that's a really interesting argument for, you know, considering the peers of your children and how your kid is just likely to rise or fall to the level of his or her peers.
It's actually the advice I see in that is that if you are doing really poorly, if you're a waitress at Denny's and you don't want your kid to grow up in a bad area, that you should rent somebody's garage in some nice neighborhood rather than, you know, a bigger place, because that's so important, this influence.
Right. And in my book, I talk about a single mom who has, you know, the smallest apartment in a really fancy town, and her kid is doing really well. And of course, it's not going to be every single kid we're talking about in general, but yeah, if you have to make certain sacrifices and decisions, you don't need, you know, a bigger apartment. You need your kid to have friends who have the kinds of values that you aspire your kid to have.
So I want to touch briefly on kids, and you write about what makes a kid likable, and unfortunately looks matter, which you can't do much about, but can parents do things to help their kids become more likable?
Absolutely. I think it's something that parents just rarely talk about with kids, and teachers too. They don't teach friendship. It's just seen as something that's supposed to naturally develop, and it does naturally develop for socially savvy kids. And then they kind of learn, quote, on the job. Once they have friends, they learn more about maintaining friends, whereas the kids who are left out of making friends go kind of slip further and further behind. So some simple things would just be, you know, talking about how do you make a friend? How do you insert yourself in a group without being pushy? You know, how do you say, can I play with you guys without interrupting the group? How do you express your feelings without being too aggressive? It's all kind of all about a balance of, you know, of being independent but also being cooperative. And just, you know, very basic skills like smiling at people, you know, could help some kids, because some kids just don't, you know, they just, it just doesn't come naturally to them. But if you can teach them some of those basics, then it can get them off that downward spiral that,
wow.
you know, I think, as you know, can be so devastating the older you get and the more behind you are socially.
Just a request. I wish you'd write an article about that, because I think people really need to know that. The stuff you're saying, people, any parent can do, ask their kids those questions. And a thing I wanted to emphasize, I see it with my neighbors. They raise their kids to be empathetic, and I think that's so important. And you suggest that parents of socially gifted kids should push them to connect with the outsiders, which is really nice.
Yeah, I think, you know, you might feel like, oh, I don't need to worry about this social stuff because my kid's really popular. Well, then it's your, maybe it's your responsibility to, yeah, to instill some leadership skills in your child and say, you know what, you seem to be really good at making friends. Is there someone at school who isn't so good at that, you know, that you could help? And I think, you know, children do, you know, they have their aggressive tendencies that are natural, but, you know, they also have their empathetic tendencies. So I think there's a way to be proactive about this stuff and talk about it in the home the way we talk about, you know, the history lesson that you learned today or the math lesson.
I think that's great. Now, you had a radical idea. One professor, James Olson, he says that he thinks removing a rejected kid from school is a good plan, which I wish my parents did for me. But he also, I mean, this isn't just like, you know, crazy talk. He talks about beefing up this kid's social skills, like by learning karate, which he says teaches emotional regulation, not just moving them to the next school and letting them get rejected again.
Right. So his point is that, you know, by the there's this sort of secret, or not secret, but unspoken process by which every classroom decides who is going to be the reject, who's going to be the class clown, who's going to be the isolated kid. And once you have that label, it's just very hard to go against that label and to convince everyone otherwise. So his point was, you know, we know this is damaging. So if it seems like your kid has really been labeled as the reject, maybe it is better to put him in a new environment. But as you say, don't just drop him in and watch the same thing unfold again, but really, really beef up the kid's ability to regulate emotions, which again is that sort of scale of aggression versus timidity. And another great tip I love that he mentioned was look for a younger kid in the neighborhood who can be your kid's friend, because then your kid has some power. Your kid has something to teach the younger kid, and that can sort of boost self-esteem and help a kid who's been experiencing rejection sort of feel like the cool one, and that can carry over into his own classmates.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And Peter Gray, whom I had on my show, talks about this, how a kid throwing a ball, a 9-year-old throwing a ball to a 4-year-old can be gentle enough and then can catch the 4-year-old's wild throws.
Mm.
It's a very sweet partnership.
So that's such a sweet image. I love that. And I think, it's just a reminder that on one hand, there's the tyranny of the classroom and these strict roles, but then there's also the world outside the classroom where your child can develop social skills in healthier contexts.
Now, I like that you write about the upside to some of the dark sides of friendship, and you say that some of friendship's power to shape us and teach us is within its less sweet traits, like that friendships aren't always symmetrical, and it's something that where you have to look at that in retrospect and process it to make that work for you.
Right. So I think there's so much in the culture right now about bullies. We're so sensitive to that, and, you know, rightly so. But there are these other sort of flavors that actually can really help you develop, even though they're not completely positive. So an example would be the rival. And, you know, I have a story in the book about a woman who was from a rather small town, was a wonderful singer, beautiful singer, but just so happened that there was one girl who was a slightly better singer who always won every competition every year, and this really pushed the first girl, and it was hard. It made her develop stage fright, but then when she finally broke out of the small pond of that, she found that she was much better prepared for a career in music because she had that intense rivalry.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. You say the same about an enemy, that it provides opportunities for personal and social growth. And mm-hmm. I had Oprah Zuron talking about PTSD, and he said, what's the story you tell about something to process it? How do you make it into a learning situation? I think that's very important to sort of, post-process how you dealt with your enemy, how you would be smarter to deal with them in the future.
Right, and you can think of almost a psychodynamic way of looking at it would be the enemy might represent a part of yourself that you don't like. And so you can sort of ask yourself, do I want to develop that part, or why does that part bother me? Or it can just be a way for you to define yourself against someone. And that can be helpful because it's a big task to define yourself and find your identity. So if an enemy kind of helps you be the opposite, then that can be really helpful in affirming who you are.
So next we're going to talk about Super Friends. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Carolyn Flora, and her book is Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. So you wrote about this guy, Richard Levinson, who's pretty old from what I recall, and he's one of these people who's able to maintain these 40-year lifelong friendships. You call them Super Friends. And so what I wanted to know, people who have these friendships, you know, did they just get lucky in meeting high-quality people as a kid?
No, I think it's, there might be an element of that, sure, but I think it's really, I think for him and a lot of people, it just comes that they just take so much joy, experience so much joy with their friends, that they get into these habits of contacting them frequently or having, set dates. Maybe once a year he has lunch with one friend, for example. And they just get into these habits that continue on and sort of bring them that joy that originally connected them with that person. And then Richard also attributes his all of his wonderful friend connections to having been single for a long time. He didn't get married till he was 50, so friends were his family. When he did get married, he didn't drop his friends. He married someone who's very social, and they go on double dates almost every night, I think. They love seeing each other and reflected in these other friends. They like, he likes hearing his wife tell a funny anecdote. She likes him to watch him tell these stories to their other friends, and it kind of keeps their marriage very vital and fresh. He just feels like the happiest moments of his life have been, in great conversation and bouts of laughter with his friends. And I think all of us can kind of use that as an example to just remember to get into those habits of regular contact with the people we know we're going to get a lot out of, talking with.
Yeah, I think that's true. But you also write about the other side, your dark side of friendship, the negative friend rut, and how friends can spread negative norms like obesity. And you say it might slightly alter our view of what kind of body size is acceptable if you have a friend who's, say, 10 pounds heavier.
Right. So this really excellent, social network research by James Fowler and Nicholas Christakis shows that things like weight gain, smoking, drinking, happiness, even a lot of behaviors spread through friend groups. And in the the negative side that you raised, if your friends kind of start getting fast food once a week, over time you just sort of think that's normal and that's what's done, and you may not even question it. And before you know it, you've gained weight. So the answer is not to dump your friends if they're getting chubby, but it's to reverse the tables and just remember that you can be a good influence on them and start nominating a healthier restaurant.
Now, talk a bit about cross-race friendships. What does the research show on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, cross-race friendship is not that common. There was some recent research stating that sort of affirms some things in the book about small schools versus large schools. If we go to a large school, we tend to pick people who are more similar to us because we have a larger pool to pick from, and we want to sort of satisfy this similarity drive, this drive to pick someone like us. If you're at a smaller school, you may just not have the option of picking someone just like you because there's a smaller pool. But what psychologists have found is that those friendships where there's a difference, and that could be race or class or you know, some other factors, but those are actually satisfying friendships. So in other words, we're not naturally drawn to people of different races when it comes to friendships, but if we can forge those friendships, it can actually be more satisfying than our sort of default.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful to realize that probably because of our evolved psychology, we're attracted to like wants like, but that mm-hmm. if you can break out of that and maybe really see the beauty and interest in being around people who have a different background, you can sort of cultivate that.
Right, and, you know, the best way to sort of combat prejudice and biases is through friendship, because it's just sort of develops that kind of empathy where you have these people in your mind when you're processing kind of abstract events and world news, et cetera. And so you have just like a much more empathetic take, and you're less susceptible to fall into this kind of in-group, out-group psychology that, as you know, we're kind of wired to do.
Now, back to bad company, the dark side of friendship. People often stay in destructive friendships out of a sense of history. They've known the person for so long, they can't imagine that they would end it.
That's right. And I think, you know, we've all had this experience of if there are family ties, it can get very complicated. If you have other mutual friends, you sort of feel like you can't extricate yourself from the web of the friendship, and so it can take extra effort to break it off with a friend who shares a lot of your life history and who you sort of feel you can't really cast aside just out of reasons of loyalty or habit or obligation to other family members.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize the difficulty of that to help people break up. And you write about drift, which Gretchen Rubin defines as the decision you make by not deciding or decision that only has consequences for which you don't take responsibility, talking about this in relation to friendship, in that drift comes about when you do things because the people around you are doing them. And this may also relate to not breaking up with a friend.
Right. So this concept, I think it's so important because it's one of the subtle ways friends influence us. I mean, if you have a really terrible, quote unquote, toxic friend, you know that she's a bad influence on you. But maybe you have some nice friends who, you've been hanging out with for a long time. But if you kind of stop and analyze it, you realize that they've kind of gone into this direction that you didn't really envision yourself going in, and that you've gone along with them because you're just getting swept up in that drift. So, you know, example would be if just you never saw yourself as someone who wanted to settle down early and have kids, but all your friends are doing that and you're feeling like, well, I guess you might as well, then it might take befriending some people who maybe have more career ambitions or something like that to kind of remind yourself of the path that would be better for you. So it's not a matter of judgment, one is good or one is bad. It's about making sure your friends are sort of aligned with your values so that you don't get drifted into their values system.
I like how you put this in the book. You say that the right crew validates who you are and also projects an ideal version of yourself. I think that's a really great way to look at it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It's like, you know, the easiest way to kind of reach a goal, whether it's to lose weight or you know, have a different type of career, is to just align yourself with friends who are doing that, because the social bonds and the drive to be like your friends or be liked by your friends is much stronger, I think, than our personal reserves of willpower.
Yeah, it's very important to recognize that. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Carlin Flora, and her book we're discussing is Friendfluence, the surprising ways friends make us who you are. You have some great quotes in your book. You quote Oscar Wilde, a true friend stabs you in the front. But you say, you know, close friends actually seem to avoid extreme honesty in ways that can hurt us.
Yeah, this is a really, really delicate dance. I think, you know, close friends are... It's very hard for, they want to protect our feelings so much, and they're so kind of over-empathizing with us that it can be hard to give that really honest feedback. So, but I think if you have a really close friend who can be supportive, say 90% or 95% of the time, but who can occasionally give you feedback that's a little hard to hear, then you're really making the most of kind of the greatest benefit, I think, of close friendship, which is that person sees your behavioral patterns, they see how you're making yourself unhappy, and if you can, you know, take the hard advice from them once in a while, that's really a catalyst to change.
Yeah, I think that's a valuable quality to have personally. And I do this with my friends. I tell them in the most kind ways. There are just times when you see that somebody's really hurting themselves. They're doing something damaging. They shouldn't be driving because they've had too much to drink or whatever. And you need to stop them and take away their keys and be willing enough to be a jerk and possibly lose their friendship to protect them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think you have to look at yourself and say, do I want a cheerleader or do I want a friend who really sees all sides of me and can help me grow? So I think the latter is just a greater, more aspirational type of friendship where two people truly support each other and love each other but are also not afraid to say, you know, this is what you're doing. You're doing this again, and why don't you try this other thing? And it can really be eye-opening.
Yeah, my best friend is a woman who will tell me, she wrote back, gave me some notes on my book. She said, this is boring. But you know what? Better that she tells me than a reviewer says, this is boring to thousands of people.
Right. And I think if you can really strike that balance where someone is, you know, very gentle and sort of careful with your feelings, but at the same time, can give you that more difficult feedback, then that actually gives you a great sense of security because you can really know that they love you, flaws and all.
Yeah, they have your back. And of course, the person we are good friends with, this woman really respects me and vice versa. So it's not like somebody just saying, oh, this is all bore, you know, who's never said any nice thing to you, you know. So...
Right. And I think part of it is also, you know, kind of comforting them in the way they need to be comforted. Like you can tell if you're a sensitive friend when the person's ready to get some tough love and when they just need, you know, comfort and affirmation. So, you can sort of switch modes if you're a really adept friend.
Yeah. And that's important, too, to sense which people can deal with what. I was talking to Greg, my producer and boyfriend, the other day about being at this party where this woman said this thing that was just the setup for the best joke in history. And I just looked at him because that was all I could do, so I wouldn't say anything because she was really sensitive. And that's what you have to do with your friends is know when they have that weak spot and be gentle with the friends who require that gentleness.
Exactly. Yeah. You really do have to pick up on those cues and don't just... have your own agenda as to when a person should hear constructive criticism.
Now, you had this fascinating research. You talk about the misperception of us by friends, a form of cognitive bias where friends may misperceive us because they're so invested in the relationship and need to believe certain things about us so as to not rock its foundation.
Right. So it's sort of that... And it's kind of a positive illusion, I guess you could call it. And I think this can happen in marriages too. And it's a good thing if you kind of want to see your partner in slightly rosy terms because it helps you stay together through the rough patches. So I think it's kind of akin to the same process. So a very close friend might, but that said, I do think that close friends can also really see us, see things that we can't see about ourselves. And there's really fun research about how our friends can guess our IQ better than we can guess our own IQ. And they can judge whether we're charming better than we can judge ourselves. And there are just ways that friends know us better than we do.
That's very interesting stuff. And I want to talk about the bad friends, the toxic friends. You quote Susan Shapira Barash, who says that we believe that friendships won't end, whereas most dating relationships are expected to end. So we can tend to keep toxic friends in our lives just out of that expectation.
Right. And I think, you know, women sometimes especially feel like failures if a friendship doesn't work out because, maybe they were raised to really prioritize these relationships, and they don't understand or realize that conflict is part of friendship, first of all, and then second of all, that not all friendships do last. And I think, Amy, that's why it's so hard to go through a friend breakup, because even though friend breakups or drifting apart is normal, we think of this sort of best friend forever ideal, and so we're not really given the sympathy that people who are going through romantic breakups are given.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing because people don't realize how devastating these are. You wrote about going through one. I've gone through one without, and this is my best friend, and he dumped me without explanation. And I thought, oh, my God, is he dead? What's wrong? You know, and I wrote a column on this about that if you're going to break up with a friend, you need to tell them not just disappear unless it's somebody you've known for, you know, 3 weeks.
Yeah, I have had a similar experience that I actually didn't write about in the book, but where it's just an awful feeling. You wonder, what did I do? What did I do? You're scrutinizing all of your interactions. And it is sort of, I think people feel they can get away with that because we don't have the rituals that a romantic breakup, you know, sort of has, the breakup talk, you know, for example, that you have with a romantic partner. I don't think there's that same sort of cultural imperative to break off a friendship in a certain way, and so that can leave people in these really devastating experiences where someone they might have known, you know, for years and years is suddenly out of their life, and there's not really a proper way to talk about it or grieve it, and it's losing a part of your identity.
It's very damaging, and I talked about in this column that you don't have to tell the person the truth. Look, I think you're a horrible person. I just realized it now. You can say something like, we've grown apart. You just have to give them some reason, and they'll want to believe it, and to not give them more, even if they press you, because the important thing is giving them, I hate this word, closure, to tell them, okay, something happened, the spark is gone, but that to give them something that it's, you know, so they're not just wondering all the time into this black hole.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of just managing the expectation that, look, I'm not interested in continuing that friendship, and that obviously stings, but yeah, it's much better than what you're talking about, which is where you're just left not knowing why this connection is gone.
Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Somebody in our chat room, Jim P., said that men understand better that you can divorce friends than women do. Is that your experience?
Oh, that's interesting. I would think, I would guess that men might sort of understand that friends fall apart and maybe not be as upset about it, but I wouldn't think of men as sort of actively cutting off friendships as much, so I'm not sure which sort of mode of breakup he's talking about, but that would make sense that based on the research that men are less likely to worry if a friend just sort of drifts away.
Yeah, and I think maybe this relates somehow to the more covert nature of troubles in friendships between women. You are right about Terry After, who says that women need to take conflict out in the open and see that it's consistent with friendship, much more like men are, you know, like I was saying about they suck each other and then go and have a beer.
Right. Yeah, and I think I just love that term, consistent with friendship, because, you know, I think if you really let that sink in, that will resonate with a lot of women because women do think that conflict is the opposite of a friendship. So if you just think of it as like, yes, we're having some conflict, that's normal, that's part of friendship, let's learn how to get through it, then you can maybe preserve these long-term friendships, which are so valuable, rather than having them, you know, blow up or drift away.
Yeah, I think this is a very important part of your book, this more realistic view of friendship. It's very helpful to, you know, we've taken these views, and you talk about all these things, you know, and one of the things, just for our last question, I guess, is, you know, that sometimes a friend will go through a jerk period or a boring period or be grief-stricken and hard to be around, and, you know, how does a friend relate to that?
I think you have to take the long-term view. This is a phase, and your job is to stick with them during this phase. If, you know, one person in my book said, if you're not willing to be bored sometimes, then you can't have friends. So I think we really need to give each other a break if it comes to someone going through a phase, and just be that rock, and then you'll really be rewarded for that when you look back and realize that you've been able to maintain a friendship commitment. It's not something we celebrate a lot, so I guess my parting thought would be, if you've had a friend for 5 or 10 years, go out to dinner and celebrate it the way you would a romantic anniversary.
Yeah,
it's an achievement worth celebrating.
You know, that is a great idea, friendiversaries. You know,
yes.
We really need to prioritize this more.
A lot of people don't even know how long they've been friends with their friends, whereas people, you know, scrutinize, oh, I met him, you know, 7 years, 5 days ago. And So I just, that is like a cultural, a tiny cultural shift I would love to see, is more friendiversaries, because the impact that they can have on your health and happiness and overall well-being is so huge that we should really take a long-term friendship as a success and celebrate it as such.
I think that is really great. I think I want to ask everyone, you should all celebrate. Figure out your friendships. When did you meet them? Just like you would with a romantic partner. Celebrate your friendiversary. Take them out to dinner for being your friend. They deserve it.
They do deserve it.
So thank you so much. This has been a great show. I have been talking with Carlin Flora, and her book is Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. Thank you. This is just illuminating and exciting.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Napa Know How.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking.